Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you, and welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, my guests today, live in the studio, a couple of young men just returned from a trip to Canada, meeting up with First Peoples in their travels. We've got Callum Clayton Dixon. Callum, welcome to the program. How are you?
Not too bad.
And I must say, staff members here at 98.9 FM. And Bo Spirum.
Hang on, Bo. Not too bad.
All good?
Yep.
Deadly. Bo, tell us your mob, your country.
Before I start, Yama, Blue Baron, Kapungunugul, Marigabi Gimilarang. Yama, where I come from, means welcome. Kapungunugul is my grandmother's clan group, and Marigabi is my grandfather's clan group, which makes my bloodline connection to the Gimilarang Nation. That's where Dad's from. He was born out there on the mission. Mum, she's from Brewarrina, but she was born at Garuga on a reserve out there. Then later on in their lives, they got taken to the Dodge City, the mission out in Bree there, where they spent a bit more of her life. Then she moved to Sydney. She got sent to boarding school.
All right. Callum, tell us your mob, your country.
My nation is Nganyawana. My clan is Himbarong, and my totem is the echidna or iwara in our language.
And what part of Australia is that?
That's in northern New South Wales, Armidale, Yooralla, Walker.
All right. Now, you guys did a trip across to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Just come back a week ago. Not even a week ago.
Yep.
Last week today.
All right, been back a week. What was the plans? What was the intentions? Why did you go across?
Looking back, you know, a delegation, you know, went to China, a delegation, you know, went to New Zealand, you know, and a delegation, you know, went over to Libya and other parts of the countries, you know, and I guess, you know, we wanted to do something, you know, like our old people did, you know, back in the day. And I guess, you know, just get knowledge, you know, from mob who have been, you know, had the same end of the stick as us, you know, and like one of the things we were talking about in Canada was like how our governments talk to each other, you know, so it's about time as First Peoples, you know, we start, you know, that dialogue. And, you know, that was, you know, one of the main reasons, you know, was to get dialogue, you know, with our peoples, you know, across the world.
Mm. And I must also not forget the young women that were with you.
Yep. Mariki Onus and Pikiri Ruska. Mm. Pikiri from Stradbroke Island, Gurumpul, and Mariki Onus is Gunai and
Kundijamara
from down Victoria Way.
Mm-hmm. Very good. You spent some 4 weeks over there?
Yeah, 4 weeks.
All up, your travels? Was it 4 weeks?
Travelled a good 12,000 kilometres from west coast to east coast.
Wow.
Yeah. Started in Vancouver, then headed straight across the country to New Brunswick and then came back to Montreal.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're also linked into the APG, the Aboriginal Provisional Government, with the passport.
Mm-hmm.
So we went over there as delegates of the APG to learn from the experiences of native peoples over there in terms of how they're resisting and how they're reconstructing both their culture and their political identity. So we went over there with the Aboriginal passports, I guess, as an act to try and inspire other young Aboriginal people to be proud in our political identity as a distinct peoples. So it was very good in terms of how many positive reactions we got from people back home saying, oh, where can we get these passports? What are the passports about? That was good.
Good, yeah. What about the reaction with customs here in Brisbane when you tried to come back home with the with that passport? What was the reaction there?
We walked up together and handed the passports over. He grabs his, you know, like there's a bit of a shock on his face, and then he looked at us and then looked at the passports again, and, you know, kept asking us, do you have an Australian passport? We didn't deny it. Like, we didn't say, no, we don't. We just said, you know, we're Aboriginal people. You know, we're coming home and we're travelling on Aboriginal passports. You know, we just repeated that there. He got sick of us. They said, no, you go over to Sidia. I'll get someone to deal with you. And then for the next 20 minutes, three to four different people, you know, kept coming up asking us. they were passing a passport around, have a look at it. Not there. I think they must have went and searched up the history of it. Not there. And
they photocopied it. They came back over with a couple of photocopies of each of our passports.
Mm.
Yeah. And what they said in the end was, after they hassled us for a good 10-15 minutes, was, okay, we're not going to stamp your passports. We don't really want you to do this in the future, but you can go through. So at the end of the day, we got through with our Aboriginal passport without having to provide any other documentation whatsoever.
All right.
And the same for the girls.
Yeah. And on the incoming passenger card where it says to put your nationality, we didn't put Australian, we put, as per our passport, Aboriginal.
Mm-hmm. And you use that passport in your travels in different places in Canada? Different provinces or communities?
I think we use it like at one of the native servos, like on the community, because they have like status cards and they get like
discounted tax-free fuel.
Yeah.
And I think these fellas used it for some petrol.
To refill, and we got native prices that are non-native prices with our Aboriginal passports. Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah.
What were some of the common things you saw that... you could relate to back home here, and what were some of the differences over there?
I guess
what sticks out.
Similar
experiences.
Yeah, like, isn't it? Similar experiences.
Colonized
like
people, yeah, an ancient culture.
Mm. Mm. Like certain communities would go to, you know, half the whole town will speak language. And the next community you go to, you know, there's one or two family members, you know, like our family groups that speak language. You know, like the dispossession and the loss of language and culture, you know, was quite big over there. And then like over there, they have the big thing of the missing and murdered Aboriginal women, you know, which is in the thousands.
I think over 2,000 now, since the 80s or the 90s.
Mm. And like that was very, very similar to the deaths in custody that we have over here. So like we'll explain that there. And then they have the 60s scoop. Which was after like the Stolen Generation and the reservation schools over there, you know, like we were on a panel discussion in Montreal, and these two aunties, you know, started talking about, and we were just sitting back looking at each other, thinking, you know, bloody hell, you know, this is
exactly the same,
like listening to, you know, the aunties and uncles back home, you know,
talking about how she was taken from her parents, adopted into a white family, never reconnected with her family for a long time, and this was in the 60s.
Mm.
So they had the residential schools where thousands of native kids were taken off. They had their hair cut off. They had to choose an English name. So exactly the same stories of, like, when I was listening to, as Bo said, these two ladies talk about their stories and their history, that resonated very strongly with me in terms of what happened to my grandfather. Mm. And she showed a bit of a trailer to this documentary she was making about the 60s scoop. And it's hovering around this circle of five Native people talking about their experiences as part of this. And one of the guys said, they actually tried to scrub the brown off my skin with a wire brush. So then hearing that story and then comparing that to when my grandfather's sister told me that they'd scrub her with kerosene. So it's so... And it brought tears to my eyes. It's so scary how across the other side of the world, a whole other Indigenous group has experienced exactly the same thing as we have.
Mm. Mm. You attended some of the cultural events?
Went to a powwow, and like some of the places we visited, they don't welcome. They don't welcome.
So they've got protocol.
Yeah, protocol. Yeah.
Come to the country.
We had like communal pipe, so like men and women can share that pipe. Smoking the pipe. We had some young fellas get up and like perform their crobby for us out there, which was dirty. Like this one little fella in Ottawa, he sung a song, played a drum, done a jingle dance, done a hoop dance. You know, little, you know, 12-13 year old little fella.
Wow. And he had about 12 or 13 hoops. Swinging around him and everything. That was really cool to see.
Wow.
Singing in his own language. And, yeah. A lot of pride.
Into a Plains mob, eh? Plains Indians that do the hoop dance. I saw a group out here 30 years ago.
I think she was Cree. Mother was Cree.
Yeah,
Plains in it.
In that open country. They came out here on tour doing the hoop dance and stuff. It was amazing to see in full full traditional dress and stuff that. It's just fantastic, you know, beautiful to see.
We ended up going to a place called Kanawage in Mohawk territory. And a couple of days before we got to Montreal, we got a message from someone saying, oh, the Mohawk Nation, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, have invited you to come and go through traditional protocol in one of their traditional longhouses in Kanawage.
That's Mohawk country, eh?
Yeah, yeah, and get your passport stamped. Because the Mohawks and the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, which is a confederacy of six Native nations over there, they've actually got their own passports just like we do, and they use them all the time. Like their lacrosse teams, whenever they go anywhere, they use their own passport. So we went into this big wooden longhouse. The girls went in through one door, and we went through another door. Then we sat on one side of the room, us four, the delegation, and then all the Mohawks, the clan mothers and the chiefs all sat on the other side. And then one after the other, two Mohawk men got up and literally reeled off in their own language a whole speech for about 10-15 minutes each. It was intimidating, to say the least, sitting there and not being able to understand what they're saying, and also the fact that we weren't able to respond in that same way.
In the own language and stuff.
But it was also very inspirational to see what we can recover, what we can rebuild.
Language. Mohawks are English-speaking mob, unlike a lot around Montreal and stuff. They're Francophone mob, French-speaking. But language generally for you, the people you met with, you would have met with some French-speaking. First peoples over there, as well as English-speaking, or what?
Like a friend of ours, Menu, he speaks French, and
his friend.
I forgot his name, but like all he could speak was French, hardly any English. And actually, they're actually reservation because of the influence around their reservation. They speak French in it and their language.
Now, there's a distinction or a classification of reservation mob and non-res mob in Canada.
There's over there. They've got three kinds of treaties, and then they've got natives with no treaties. So you got friendship treaties, which were signed in the beginning and were signed on terms of goodwill and the idea of coexistence, and they worked for a while and then were broken by the colonizers. And then there was the numbered treaties, which were pretty much the idea of them was to say, okay, you sign this treaty, we'll give you a little bit of land to live on as a reservation over here, but you cede the rest, and that reservation will still be under the control of the federal government. And then there's the modern-day land claims, or the modern-day treaties, which are mostly happening in British Columbia. So out of all that, some of them... So they have a system of status over there. So you got non-status Indians, you got status Indians, and then you got treaty Indians. So the non-status Indians don't get anything. So they don't get the discount fuel, they don't get the free education, they actually have no reservations. They have only got kind of like community co-ops. Then you've got the status Indians, which have their own reservations. But if they marry or have a child with a non-Indian person, that child loses their status. And it used to be the case that if you were a native woman and you married a non-native man, the native woman would lose her status and the child would lose their status.
Right.
Whereas if you were a native man and you married a white woman, the woman would gain status, and the kid would also have status.
All right.
They amended that, so now if you marry a non-native person in general, whether you're man or woman, the kid loses their status.
All right.
So I guess it's that whole thing about breeding us out.
All right. Interesting. Bush tucker. You tasted in there, bush tucker?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Was a bear.
Moose.
Yeah? Yeah.
The girls tasted deer. We had salmon.
Elk.
Dried out salmon and dried out elk.
Grouse, which is this funny little chicken thing.
A bird thing. They're a bit slow.
They're a bit slow. Yeah. We went to this, one of the first places we stopped was the Unist'ot'en blockade. Unist'ot'en is a clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation in British Columbia. And one of the native fellas there, he woke up one morning, got out of his tent, and saw these two grouse birds sitting outside his tent. He got a stick and knocked one over the head, The other one kind of looked around, didn't really do anything. Knocked the other one over the head, yeah. Chucked him in the bag, yeah. Chucked him in this plastic bag, and handed them to one of the girls and said, "Oh, here's. Do you know how to prep game?" And yeah, so she had to go and find someone to help her
pluck it and dress it. All right.
That was good. Because we rocked up there, you know, then, and just like anywhere you go around here, you know, when you see, you know, native people, they show, you know, like really, really good love in it there, you know.
Mm.
Like when we rocked up to the...
You're accepted, didn't they? Take you in.
Yeah.
Welcome you.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we rocked up in Elsie Pogtog, like the Mi'kmaq nation out there, and, you know, we were driving for about 13 hours we got there, you know, we just met this family, you know, out of yarn with them. She looks at us, goes, "Oh, you can come back home now, have a wash, you know, wash your clothes as well, you know." And then we got to her house. She looked at us, she goes, "Oh, you know, I don't have much room in my house, you know, but if you have tents, you know, set them up in your backyard, you know, use a ride, you know, for as long as you want to stay." So we all had a wash, and by the time we all set our tents up, you know, she was making phone calls, you know, to all the mob out there to come over and, you know, meet with us, you know. So she called up the women's drum circle. They come there, sung a couple of songs, called up the Warrior Society, you know, they come down out of yarn with us, you know. And it was freaky, you know, because everybody that rocked up, you know, they all had camo gear on, and, you know, every second person that walked past the house, you know, he was like, "Yeah, you know, he's one of our warriors, you know." Mm. She was on the front line with us, you know. You talk to one of the yarnies, she's like, "Yeah, you know, I was throwing my coffee at the cops," and that means, you know, like
they all had stories of resistance.
About being there, like on that day, all them few days, you know, when I was on the front line with the police officers, you know.
It's October last year.
That's the ochre.
Oh, no, no, no.
Not ochre. This
was in Mi'kmaq territory in New Brunswick.
Yeah, you're not on, yep.
Last year they came close. I guess they came close to an ochre crisis.
Mm.
No guns or anything, but footage of hundreds of Mi'kmaq warriors, men and women, clashing on with riot police, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Mm. And then you see in the video footage these guys with M16s and all the full camo gear. Right. And dogs, you name it. And they, one young fella there, he took us around and showed us, "Oh, these are where the soldiers were. These are where the police were. These are where they were shooting beanbags and rubber bullets at us.
Mm. Wow.
This is where this elder got pepper sprayed in the face. Mm. This is where this person got, I think one guy got his leg all messed up from a beanbag round.
I think he almost got his leg amputated because he got shot with a beanbag in it.
So, and that happened October last year when they clashed with police over a proposed fracking of their land, coal seam gas mining.
So they're up against the coal seam gas as well. What about their understanding and their knowledge of our struggle and our existence here and survival and the fact that we are the first people of the planet? How is that seen or perceived over there? What did you see? How do you feel?
Well, I guess if you hang around, I guess it'll be the same back here, you know, like the circles that know about different indigenous resistance around politics and the resistance around the world, then, you know, like they would know, like, you know, a few people heard about the 10 Embassy, you know. Actually, one of the guys we met, he was over here 2012 when the big...
For the 40th anniversary.
Yeah, for the 40th anniversary.
When Julia lost her shoe.
Yeah, yeah. When she lost her shoe, like he was over here.
And the police lost their minds.
And then, like, a few of our friends that we, like, got in contact with before we went over there, like, they knew about our struggle over here and that there. But it was quite interesting, you know, like... talking to some of them fellas and... they'd think we're Australians, but no, we're Aboriginal people, you know.
Yeah.
You know, do you call yourself Canadians? Like, no.
Yeah,
we call ourselves Indians. Yeah, we're natives.
So you were able to explain
that.
Yeah.
That's something that the Mohawks made very clear when they did a translation of those speeches I was talking about.
Mm.
They said, the reason we have these passports and the reason we identify the way we do is because we are not Canadians and we have that right to a distinct political status on both sides of the border, because the Mohawk Nation is... on both sides of the US-Canadian border.
Yes, yes. Mm. Wow. Were there any instances or experiences where it made your hair stand up? Something that might have resonated with you or something might have freaked you out, just made your hair stand up? Any of that sort of stuff happen?
I guess like listening to
rocking up to like you didn't get chased. You didn't get chased by a big brown bear on. That'll make your hair stand up.
We saw a few bears over there.
Did you really?
Yeah. Black bears, yeah.
In the distance.
Wow.
But we turned up to
Winnipeg,
the Unistoten camp in British Columbia at 3 a.m. in the morning after driving 60 kilometers. So we drove from Vancouver to northern British Columbia, which is a good 15-16 hour drive. And then we went along this 60 kilometer road, dirt road, logging trail, I think it was. Mm. We rocked up at this bridge, and all these big signs were across the bridge. Big signs that said, no consent, no entry, things like that. Mm. Big stop signs and everything. And then all of a sudden, all these big spotlights were on us. Mm. People were running across the bridge, and there was actually a patrol car on there. And these are all native patrol, native activists who are blocking this bridge. So what they're doing is they are preventing the development of three different pipelines. One is liquid natural gas. Another one is material from the tar sands, which if anyone's watched Lord of the Rings, if you've seen what Mordor looks like, that's what the tar sands look like. So they are blocking the development of three big pipelines by blocking this bridge. So whenever anyone comes up to this bridge, you've got to go through a protocol, and they ask you five or six questions like, who are you? What's your name? Where are you from? What do you want to do in my territory? Will your visit to my territory, how will that benefit my people? Uh-huh. And have you got any connections to government or industry? But what they did, because we rocked up at 3 a.m. in the morning, they're like, nah, you guys got to stay over this side. This is a weird time for you guys to be arriving here. Yeah. We're a bit suspicious. So you got to wait till morning until we confirm who you are.
All right.
So they brought a wheelbarrow full of wood for a fire, mm-hmm. and some food in there and everything over the bridge for us. But we kind of just jumped in the car and went back to sleep for a few hours until they came over and we went through the protocol and then we crossed. So I think that was a real spin out in terms of how staunch they are when they talk about and when they act their responsibilities to protect their lands.
Their sovereignty, yeah, living their sovereignty.
Mm, they're living their sovereignty.
Yeah, yeah. All right. The tent embassy, tent-style protests. Mm. You saw some of that over there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like these fellas, they rocked up to Vancouver a day before I did, so they got to go into a tent city that they had in one of the major parks there in Vancouver, and like they were saying, now it's just like a tent embassy back home in it there. But, you know, that they were fighting for housing there. And then the one that we saw in Winnipeg, Winnipeg, they were, like, the women actually started up, like a lot of Native women, because of the missing and murdered Aboriginal women.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the week we actually landed in Vancouver was they found a 15-year-old young Native woman in a river in it there, you know?
Mm.
And, like, it's very common over there, you know, to find Native women, whether it's along the river or along the road.
Wow.
So, like, the women set that up. We rocked up to Winnipeg. Someone said, oh, you know, there's a tent city down there. I was like, oh, radio, okay, then we'll get in there the next day. So we went there that night, and then we were spinning out, you know, just looked just like an embassy, whether it was down in Canberra or in Brisbane, and you know, we were spinning out. And, you know, we stayed there for a few hours at a, you know, asked them, how come, you know, you're setting this up and how long you've had it for. And then they went through the whole story of the missing and murdered Aboriginal women out there, and it's about 2,000 to 3,000 missing and murdered Aboriginal women. Like last year, they wanted to have an inquiry and add these papers, you know, and there's actually an image of one of the politicians throwing the inquiry papers, you know, on the ground out there. You know, so you can see like the real big, you know, the disrespect, you know, from the politicians, just like back here, you know, when we want to do the exact same thing. But then we come back the next morning, you know, like around lunchtime, and then they're like, oh, you know, there's a protest going on down here, you know. You just want to come along. So me and Callum went along in there, and the girls, they went and picked some medicine in there, some sage and some sweetgrass. And then, we all jumped on the bus and caught the bus down there. And then there was a four-lane highway, and then the native fellas, they had these, what was it, tubes?
Arm tubes
at them. They're like PCP pipe, and then they have like this this other pipe going directly through the middles, and so you can hold it, and so cops can't rip you.
So you poke your arm up the pipe,
yeah.
Mm.
And then grab hold of the piece that goes down through the center,
yeah,
and then people can lock on.
Yeah, lock
like
on.
Wow. Okay, so they can't just come along and break the hand grip when you're gripping each other or you've got you're locking arms.
Yeah.
It's more difficult to break
that.
Yeah,
it's more difficult to break.
Handy little tactic. Handy little tactic.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. So, like, there was about four native fellas. They all jumped up there first, you know, and kind of like me and Callum are waving the flags and taking photos and that there. And then I was like, you boys didn't jump in? We're like, yeah, you know, of course. So we jumped on. And just as we jumped on, that's when all the media started coming out there too. So there was
CBC, which is their equivalent to the ABC.
And then I think one of the native team, APTN came down and started filming. And then like 2 days later, like one of the women that was involved, you know, she messaged us. You know, all these links to the news out there, and you see our big heads.
Yeah, good one, huh? So arming up over there in that particular instance had take on a different meaning. Arming up, you've got these tubes up your arms and you're locking hands so to arm up there in that particular instance.
Yeah, yeah.
And have a very different meaning.
Mm. What do you say the best form of direct action is non-violence?
Oh, no, the most effective way of getting our voice across to the mainstream is by non-violent direct action through things like blockading highways or blockading mines or pipelines.
Tenemacies.
That sort
of stuff.
Occupations. Occupations and blockades were the two things that we noticed were most effective over there.
Yes. Mm. It's interesting they used the tents and that you remind me of a time when about 15 years ago or so, me and Coco Wharton were in Mexico City. And he got there a few days before me, and I couldn't find him. And in the Zocalo, the city square, massive big place, 10 times bigger than our city square, like it's a proper big city square, and all this ancient sort of architecture and stuff. It looked like a Roman movie sort of thing where you see those big arenas where the lions come out to fighting them fellas and eating them fellas, you know. It was sort of like that. Well, Coco's down there, camped with this mob. They all protesting, and they got tent type things there, all under plastic sheets and tents and things like that for shelter. Mm. And Coco's in the middle of their mob, and so it's interesting to talk about these embassies or these tent city things and that. I mean, and then to find our own man here, local fellow Wayne Wharton, in the middle of it, couldn't speak English. I said, "Where you been?" He said, "I've been here, brother. Look." Well, this mob, I said, you can't speak Spanish.
Yeah.
No, he said, but we've been getting on all right.
Yeah.
He was there for 3 or 4 days, and it just blew me away. I thought, that's deadly, that our mob can meet up, even in another country and stuff, and find their way around and get by. But for him to be in the centre of that, of the Zocalo in Mexico City was just amazing.
Mm.
The terminology, native, what's their preferred, they obviously... that's why I use the term here. They obviously is an acceptable term to them to be regard. They regard themselves as native as opposed to us here. Yeah. The last thing we want to be known as a native.
Mm. Yeah, I guess they got a range of different terms they
as we
use.
Do.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Mm. Or as so, there's a range of words that they use themselves, and there's a range of words that the government or other people use to describe them. So a lot of the old school. A lot of the older native people over there will call themselves Indians or be happy to call themselves, be calling themselves Indians. But a lot of younger people will reject that and say, nah, get with the times when we're not called Indians. Indians, that term came about because Columbus thought he rocked up in India.
He was in India.
And it was interesting to hear a lot of them, they rejected the term or didn't really use the term First Nations. And we asked them why not. And they said because it was a government coined term. And Manu, as Bo mentioned before, an Anishinaabe man, like he said that he wasn't so keen on the word First Nations because he said you put the word first in front of nations and that kind of gives legitimacy to the nation that has come over the top of us. Yeah, so I guess in terms of the terms that they use themselves, it's native. Some of them call themselves Aboriginal.
Mm.
Some of them call themselves Indians, and some of them call themselves First Nations.
Yeah, very similar to here.
Mm.
Some of us, our mob, we don't use it. I've never heard of the term native amongst our own mob here, but Aborigine and Indigenous and First Peoples or First Nations, there's that use or preference. And wherever you are, there's a different sort of a... the choice is there, and it's different in different places. Yeah. The residential schools, that was where they took young people, wasn't it, the kids, and placed them in schools. Was there some, agreement or compensation reached regarding the treatment of those kids about 5 years ago or so, do you know?
I'm not sure if it was compensation. There may have been. All I know that it was a kind of Kevin Rudd-style apology by Conservative Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper a few years ago. But like us here, the natives over there, they're very cynical of token apologies that really mean nothing and are just government whitewash.
And then, like we're saying earlier, in the 60s, after the residential schools, they had the 60s scoop. I think it was like the late 50s, the 60s and the 70s and up to the 80s that they, you know, where they was just grabbing the, a lot of urban Indians and that there and
adopting them
into, into white homes out there, you know. And like they had a slideshow, you know, and they had a picture of one of the ladies and her three sisters in the newspaper, you know, all like, you know, in a section where they can, you know, pick out, you know, which native you want in that there. It was pretty freaking out there, you know.
So overall, you felt relatively comfortable while you were with the First Peoples of the country. You felt comfortable with them, and they made you made you feel comfortable and welcome.
Very welcoming people.
Now some good people over that way, that's for sure. And the drumming, I saw one while I was over there in Mexico, me and Coco there. We saw a fair bit of drumming taking place, and one young fellow, he was that into it and in that much of a frenzy, he broke a finger just really going for it on them drum, you know. But the drumming is certainly something to
And the singing too,
that
makes you like the hairs on the back of your neck stand up when you hear him sing, like the men and the women, you know. It was deadly. Like when we went to the powwow, they have like the drum competitions as well, or the drummers, like the different section, the drummers will lead the different dances in that thing. Like when we went to Grand Cash in Alberta, like our friend, she took us to her brother's res or community, and he organized like his drum group to come and play, sing a few songs for us out there. And like that was the first time like we all, you know, got to sit in front of these fellas playing the drums out there, you know, and we're just sitting back and all like, oh gee, this is deadly, you know.
The revival of culture with the young people, like naming the younger, new ones coming along in their own terms and language. You see that there?
Yeah, like one of the communities. So there was 8 communities in Grand Cache. One of the communities called Victor Lake that we visited. A lady there had a home there and a family, and all of her walls were covered in language words. So right across the country, what everyone kept emphasizing was the need for us to, or Indigenous peoples in general, to bolster our resistance to colonization by reviving our culture, by reviving our language, by reviving our ceremonies, by reviving everything that underpinned our society prior to colonization.
Because
that's what gives us strength. That's what connects us back to our lands and our waters and our territories.
All right. So what do you come back with? You come back with a couple of ideas or something you want to try, or even contacts? Do you maintain communication, maintain links and exchange information now that you've made some first-hand contact with people over there? What are your plans?
I guess in terms of what we've brought back is a whole heap of lessons that we've learnt from the struggle over there. Literally, when we went over there, we thought, okay, we've been following these guys online and watching their struggle, watching their resistance. It's been pretty heated over the past few years, whether it's blockades, clashing with the police and all that sort of stuff. So what we learnt was that you must build a struggle that is based upon a resistance culture, that is based upon instilling the warrior spirit within your community, and also bolstering that, reinforcing that with the revival of culture. Yeah. That is the way you decolonize, is through resistance against colonization and then the reconstruction of the pillars of your society.
That's it, yeah. And like when we went to Mi'kmaq, everybody spoke language, you know. And then like when I asked the war chief, you know, how come everybody you know, went down there, you know, he said, you know, because they understood the importance, you know, of land, you know, the water, the air, you know, and then he said it in language, you know, I said, well, there it is, you know, that's why, you know, because they, because I think within like the last few generations, you know, they all, you know, started, you know, reviving their language, that they, you know, and then now half of everybody speaks, you know, their language on that. There's about 3,000 to 2,000 people on that reserve there, and, you know, half of them speak their language and half of them are on the front line.
Yeah, right, yep. And there'd be a big mob of them, like, as similar to here, living in cities and stuff like that as well, and making their, just making their own way.
Yeah, Winnipeg.
Visiting back to country, I imagine, like, as we do here, we go back home from time to time, yeah?
Yeah, Winnipeg has the biggest, like, urban Indigenous population in the whole country out there.
Okay, yeah.
I guess because they've got this whole reservation system over there, a lot more of them have stayed within their own their own lands. Like, there is big urban populations, but there's also really, really big populations out on these reservations, whereas a lot of our reserves, as far as I know, they're not even, no one lives there anymore. Yeah.
What was the... Yeah, so you'll continue with contracts. You saw a woman over there that had the Brisbane Blacks, the newspaper that you guys produce here in Brisbane.
Yeah. What was that? Winnipeg as well, eh?
Yeah, it was in Winnipeg.
Yeah, like the local mob there, they organised like a welcome for us, and then out of nowhere, this old white one from over Rio who lives over there now, she was there talking to us. She's like, oh, I collected these magazines when I was over there. We thought she was going to bring back, like, Tracker or NIT or Courier Mail, but she ends up bringing Brisbane Blacks, the first two issues. Yeah. It was funny, too, because, like, the month before we went flew over to Canada, we had all four... original copies, and we lost them, and then she pulls out these two copies, and then Callum tells her that there. She's like, oh, yeah, you can take them back with Jews now.
Wow.
But it was pretty funny, you know, like we had to go all the way over to Canada to
recover
find
your early copies that you had no more.
Yeah.
What a good story.
It was freaky. It was, yeah.
What a good story. So when you got back here, anything here that had changed? You only gone a month. I mean, the politics of things they're talking about. I mean, the G20 is happening. And they're talking about changing the date of the referendum. You know, Abbott saying, oh, make it 2016 or so, or whatever date, whatever you were talking about, after their elections and stuff like this. Was there anything happening here that surprised you? That it changed in that month?
We were following, I guess, online what kind of clownery that Tony Abbott was up to with the silly things he was saying, talking about how...
The most defining moment.
Yeah, the most defining...
Most defining time.
Was... colonization.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The invasion.
So yeah, it was amusing to keep.
And then like when we actually got back in the country, they had them so-called terrorist threats out there.
And we just managed to get through on our own passports.
Through the customs.
Yeah.
Our own passports.
Breached the borders.
All right. So all in all, it was a good trip.
Yeah. A lot learnt, you know, on that trip out there, you know, and like you're saying, you know, like we've made, you know, deadly contacts, you know, for life out there. You know, with a lot of mob, you know, not just in Canada, but, you know, in the States and some down in Mexico and up there as well, you know. So, you know, like, it was good because we met, like a few rappers, you know, that, you know, go that different route of you know, talking about politics and up there, you know, so make connections there as well.
Oh, good one. Good one. And back here with the G20 and stuff, I mean, I was talking to Gujul yesterday, one of the traditional owners of Cairns area, talking about the displacement of our mob, the removal of our mob from inner city and stuff. I mean, I never stopped to think about that. It was the same here in 88 for the big bicentennial. The 88 expo thing that was here. They went through Southside and just cleared it of our mob, you know, moved them out. And we need to stop and think about how the authorities, the establishment, are dealing with our mob now again. For G20, and it's happening in Cairns as we speak, where they've taken all of them long grass mob and people that are on the streets in Cairns. They don't want them. They don't want these unsightly view or that of people. It was interesting to hear Gujul's story on that. Where are we? With Abbott wanting to change the dates. Well, I mean, what are your views on the referendum and stuff here?
I guess over the past few years, we've been following it and critiquing it and talking about why we think constitutional recognition is just tokenism and more paternalism from the Australian government. And I think myself personally, I've got to a point now where it's just like, oh, he's changed it again. He's talking about it again. And I think, as Gary Foley says, like, we don't even need to be talking about this anymore. Mm. It's come to a point where government just uses constitutional recognition and things like reconciliation as a big distraction.
Mm. Mm.
And people get tied up in criticizing this kind of thing when we really just need to get on with the business that we need to get on with, and that is building a resistance movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because whether or not we get added to it, you know, what are we going to benefit from it at the end of the day? You know, some sort of equality that they, you know, push, you know, onto us, which, you know, at the end of the day is, you know, the equality that we supposedly been getting, where, you know, we've been put on the missions, you know, where our kids still get stolen, you know, where our people still, you know, get put in jail at a high rate and killed, you know, like that. That's the, you know, like that. That's what we're looking forward to. You know, that's what we've already had for the last 230 years.
They mentioned over when we're over in Canada that the government constantly uses the same tactics in terms of these big distraction, these big Trojan horses, just to throw the native people off what they really need to be doing.
Yeah. Sidetracking, like distractions.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. Yeah, we're certainly seeing that here with this proposal for constitutional recognition. And I see there's an article today in The Australian by one of the rednecks, conservatives. Can't even think of his name. Johns, yeah. Talking their usual crap. And you got to get sick of it, but like you say, it's a distraction, and we don't need the distractions. We need to stay focused on where we're going. What is it, as young First Nations people in this country, what are your main concerns?
I guess the culture and language, I guess that's the biggest concern, because like we've had the generation before us has, you know, had a big, you know, we've all had that big disconnection, you know, from culture and that there. And I think, you know, that's the biggest thing that you know, I think we all need to start reviving.
Cultural revival, language revival, and revival of our traditional practices. I believe that will give energy, give fire to the resistance movement.
Definitely, of course. Because like when we start getting, you know, like down, like when we start working out, you know, how cultural responsibilities, you know, then we'll actually start realizing, you know, hey, look out, that's wrong. You know, we can't be doing that anymore.
Yeah.
And we you know, we got to, you know, start standing up for our brother and sister there, you know. And once we understand the responsibility, you know, like that our, that our old people, you know, had, you know, like when, you know, when Cook and all them came out there, you know, they had, you know, we still have that responsibility today, you know.
And reviving our culture will, I guess, assist us in realizing once again what that responsibility is. It's not just about rights, it's about responsibilities. And the responsibilities we have to not only our own people but also our lands.
It's people and country, that's for sure, because while forever we got sick country, we're gonna have sick people. Vice versa, we got sick people, we're gonna have sick country.
That's it.
When you talk about resistance, you're talking about the assimilation policies and things like that.
Industry, assimilation policy, yeah.
I guess.
And the continuation of them.
Yeah, resistance is all about, it's all about opposing and rejecting what they're trying to put upon us, whether that's making us use their passports or whether that's them coming into our territories and ripping up our lands, destroying our rivers, destroying our lakes, destroying our water. Yeah, resistance is a whole raft of things. And that resistance goes hand in hand with the reconstruction of our culture.
Yes, I've looking for. Yeah, there it is. We're talking about some of those your travels overseas with the First Peoples over there. But more on the resistance side of things, the and assimilation policies. I mean, it's something that we need to, I suppose it's a bit of a challenge for a lot of our mob to see the policies for really for what they are.
Mm.
And I mean, we must not forget that there are people who can be embrace the assimilation policies and still remember or still know who they are. But it's something that some of us can't do as well. We know who we are, but we can't embrace the assimilation policy because we know how divisive, how destructive that it is. But at the same time, I think there's horses for courses. There's those of our mob that can work within the system. There's those of us that can't go anywhere near this, like a step, say in community, say on the ground, in community, grassroots movement, I suppose.
Mm.
How do you see it?
I guess the brainwashing, you know, of our people has been so strong, you know, and for some of us, luckily we've, you know, like a lot of our mobs steered away from that theme, you know, but I guess, it's a really, really hard thing when, you know, we see our mob in there, you know, and doing the wrong thing, you know, and, you know, it's like today, you know, we're finding more and more of them, you know, like, it's funny now because the people we're fighting against look just like us. You know, and we, you know, we've got to try and, you know, either battle that or, you know, go past that without looking like we, you know, just fighting our own mob in it there. But
yeah,
you know, I think that's the biggest thing.
That's a real challenge,
that
one. That's a real challenge, yeah. We're just about at the end of the program. I've got a track here I'd like to play, take us through close to the news. Anything else you want to say? You just want to add? Anything to say to our mob based on your experience over there?
If I could say anything, it's you know, if any of the listeners can experience what we experience, if they do ever go, or it's the Canada, New Zealand, or America, you know, like, you know, find the Indigenous mob there and, you know, spend some time with them, because, you know, they're more like us than we think. They're not, you know, and very, very similar, you know, and, you know, just those little experiences that we have with them, you know, we can get a lot out of that.
Very inspirational.
Mm. Yeah, very, very inspirational.
But we probably find similar experiences here in our own country if we travelled around here. Mm. Went north, went back to the west or south or wherever. We'd also find some inspirational
people
and movements and stuff as well, wouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So get out and have a look around is what you're saying.
Get out
and have a look around. Well, guys, thanks a lot, eh? It's good that you've done the trip. Young people, our young mob, it's good to see that you guys have made the contacts. And like you say, you've probably made lifelong friends and
definitely
stay in touch and keep connected that way. Good on you. Well done.
Thank you, Hunk.
Join me tomorrow for Let's Talk on your local First Nations station.